Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Wednesday, September 23. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a mostly sunny day with winds from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. And Cedar Rapids will see a high of 79-80 in Iowa City and then falling to a low this evening of 54 in Cedar Rapids and 55 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 7:02 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 6:56 a.m. for a total daylight period of 12 hours and 7 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, volunteers help Iowa City families learn online. A story by Grace King of the Gazette staff. While Kevin Duninguez, age 11, a sixth grader at Mark Twain Elementary, focuses on his visual learning, his younger siblings get help from volunteers who can teach them how to use the computer and access online classes. The program called Neighborhood Nests, Nurturing Every Student Together Safely, is organized and operated by local not-for-profit groups for students in the Iowa City Community School District to access free Wi-Fi and get technical and academic support from volunteers and for families to get some child care help. Kevin has been attending a Neighborhood Nests operated by Open Heartland, a not-for-profit serving families in five Johnson County mobile home communities whose residents mainly are Hispanic immigrants. When Iowa City Schools announced a virtual start to the school year, Open Heartland pivoted its mission to open a nest. The organization was founded just last year and had visited mobile home communities to play with children, drop off food, backpacks, and school supplies, and coats, hats, and gloves in the winter. Participants are operating the nest out of Parkview Church East Campus. Kevin is enrolled in online learning rather than hybrid learning and will not be returning to in-person classes this semester, even as the district transitions to standard learning on Monday. I feel pretty nervous to do this the rest of the semester. I don't want to have bad grades, he said. Coming to the nest is helpful for him and his family, he said, because his mother doesn't speak English. I'd be the one helping my siblings with online learning, he said. But at Open Heartland's nest, volunteers are there to help Kevin's 9 and 5-year-old siblings as he focuses on his own classwork. Open Heartland's nest serves up to 25 students a day at no cost to them. Anyone who comes to the nest gets his or her temperature checked and must wear a mask. Names are taken to help with contact tracing should someone test positive for COVID-19. Our goal is to get this family unit feeling empowered about how to use online learning, said Deb Dunkhase, founder of Open Heartland. The Iowa City District, which started school September 8, is continuing online-only classes until Friday, with a waiver from the Iowa Department of Education. On Monday, students who registered for standard enrollment will transition to school 50% on-site and 50% online. About 55% of Iowa City students have registered for standard enrollment. The other 45% are enrolled in online learning. Alejandra Ibarra's 3 children attend the nest at Open Heartland. Before coming to the nest, she said she didn't even know how to turn on a computer. They learn and I learn too, Ibarra said in Spanish, speaking through interpreter Elizabeth Bernal, co-founder of Open Heartland. Ibarra's children, Carolina Pacheco, age 10, Julieta Pacheco, age 6, and Romina Pacheco, age 4, are enrolled in the online learning program at Mark Twain Elementary. Ibarra chose online learning for her children as she watched cases of the coronavirus rise in Johnson County. She's scared for them, she said. I hope they can learn a little, and I hope they can succeed, Ibarra said. Missy Forbes, who is leading the Neighborhood Nests initiative, said the idea sprang out of a concern for students who don't have access to the internet and for English language learners. The organization also aims to address child care and provide academic support. Forbes is director of 4Cs of Johnson County, which opened a nest to serve families at risk of becoming homeless and to provide child care. Combined, the nests are serving about 200 students. A $50,000 grant from the City of Iowa City has helped cover some of the operating costs of the nests, but more donations and volunteers will be needed if the groups are to continue operating through the end of the school year in June 2021. All volunteers are subjected to background checks, which are provided by the district. The neighborhood centers of Johnson County will open two nests next week, one in Iowa City at St. Andrew Lutheran Church and one in Coralville at Life Church. Families who wish to use these sites will have to enroll, and there is a fee to attend the Iowa City location, which will focus more heavily on daycare than other locations. Anthony Branch, Program Director of Neighborhood Centers, said he hopes the nests will give respite, especially to older students who may be caring for their younger siblings while their parents are at work. There's going to be a lot of chaos, a lot of challenges, but there will be small moments of success we have to hang our hats on, Branch said. We have to celebrate those small little victories as we're all navigating these incredible challenges together. To find a neighborhood nest or to donate or volunteer, visit icaretogether.com/nests. And from Cedar Rapids, from the front page, long-awaited banjo block revamp gets a boost. This is an article by Marissa Payne of the Gazette staff. The city's long efforts to see a rebirth of the banjo block, a centrally located downtown property that has sat mostly vacant for years, took a major step forward Tuesday when the Cedar Rapids City Council backed plans from an Indiana developer to build a five-story complex there. The council approved a term sheet for Indianapolis-based TWG development, which boasts a track record in Cedar Rapids, to build a $51 million mixed-use facility on the block at 4th Avenue and 5th Street Southeast, which is adjacent to the Cedar Rapids Public Library and Green Square. The block is dubbed Banjo for Banjo Refrigeration, a business that long operated there. This is a site that we've tried to develop for more than 40 years, Councilmember Dale Todd said. The fact that a $51 million project is interested in this market in lieu of COVID and the economy, it's a real testament to the strength of downtown Cedar Rapids. And when the economy turns, which it's going to turn, these are the kind of projects that you're going to see more often. The approximately 200,000 square foot project would feature 244 apartments, primarily one and two bedroom units, 1,176 square feet of ground level commercial space, 147 parking stalls and amenities, including a pool, a fitness center, a bike shop, community room, and a rooftop patio. Construction is expected to begin March 1 and end March 31, 2023. The developer's portfolio already includes several apartment projects in Cedar Rapids and Marion, as well as others in Iowa. The developer would work with local, historic, not-for-profit organizations to salvage architectural materials from existing buildings and incorporate those through plaques, photographs, or other means to honor the history of the block. In addition to the workers employed in the commercial space, preliminary plans also call for the developer to employ four other workers at the property. The city would reimburse up to 100% of the incremental taxes generated by the project, said City Economic Development Analyst Caleb Mason, reaching a total present-day value of $6.2 million. But the state may roll out workforce housing tax credits, Mason said. If those are approved, he said the city would reduce its financial participation in the project based on the state incentives approved by the Iowa Economic Development Authority. Mayor Brad Hart said he anticipates this project will spur additional development to the south of the block. After some council members asked about the rent rates for the apartments in the complex, council member Ashley Banorni, who sits on the City Development Committee, said even if the complex is market rate, we definitely still need that in this area. And we know that'll help revitalize and bring some attention to our downtown businesses as well. However, a different Indiana developer, S.C. Bodner, dropped plans for the site in October 2019 after realizing the market couldn't support the high-end rents built into the funding plan. I definitely would like to see somebody redevelop this block, but I want to make sure that somebody actually does something constructive with it, Benorni said. Todd said there has been a shift in the market with the COVID-19 pandemic, as developers lose interest in building office spaces while employees work from home. Right now, literally, deals like this are not getting financed with a commercial element and or an office element, Todd said. At the end of the day, if we want to make units affordable, that means we have to kick in more incentives. That is simply the only way to do it now in this marketplace. Councilmember Todd Olson, a commercial broker who has been licensed as a realtor with Skogman Realty since 1993, said he backed the project wholeheartedly. There is no commercial tenants out there. There's no retail tenants out there. It's a different world out there, Olson said, urging creativity in city housing projects. Also from today's front page, Jones launches fight to keep Cedar Rapids police job, a story by Kat Russell of the Gazette staff. The first day Tuesday of testimony in Lucas Jones' appeal of his firing from the Cedar Rapids Police Department included video of a traffic stop he conducted just 2 days before a more infamous one that has been invoked in protests and a suit against the city. Video of that October 30, 2016 traffic stop gave little clarity when shown at the hearing, but it plays a crucial role in the department's case for ousting the officer. A former patrol sergeant, Jones was fired from the force on June 18 after officials said an investigation into that traffic stop revealed Jones violated policy when he switched off his body-worn microphone. The video, which was played for the Civil Service Commission, started with muffled, difficult-to-decipher audio that abruptly cut off during the interaction. Jones can be seen reaching into his left hip pocket before the audio cuts off, leading the department to suspect he had deliberately turned it off. Two Cedar Rapids investigators testified for the bulk of the day, focusing mostly on this traffic stop, the audio issue, and the alleged inconsistencies in Jones' explanations. Police Captain Craig Furnish was involved in the department's internal investigation of the shooting of motorist Jareem Mitchell, who Jones shot and paralyzed in the early morning hours of November 1, 2016, 2 days after the other traffic stop. According to the department, Jones saw Mitchell driving a pickup truck with an improperly displayed license plate. The plate was unlit and initiated a traffic stop. An altercation ensued between the men, and Mitchell drove off with Jones hanging on the driver's side of the door. Jones shot Mitchell 3 times, and the truck crashed. Jones' microphone in the Mitchell traffic stop was not working either, and the police department has made no attempt to explain why. Black Lives Matter movement protesters this summer have called for Jones' ouster, but the department has maintained his firing is not related to the protests. Similar to the October 30 stop involving a different driver, the recording released of the Mitchell shooting is from the cruiser's dashboard camera, which was able to capture only audio that could be heard within the cruiser. the investigation in the October 30 traffic stop and the termination letter that ultimately followed does not reference seemingly similar audio issues in the Mitchell stop, but it does hint at the possibility of a larger pattern. During his investigation into the October 30 traffic stop, Furnish said he asked Jones about the audio cutting out. Furnish said Jones denied knowing why the audio malfunctioned, adding that he had no recollection of turning the microphone off himself. Nearly 3 years later, during a deposition connected to the Mitchell shooting lawsuit, which has yet to go to trial, Furnish said Jones gave entirely different testimony, now stating he deliberately shut off the microphone to conceal that he was violating debarment policy. Furnish said he found the inconsistencies concerning, adding, "We police officers are expected and required to tell the truth, and these conflicting statements did not align as being truthful." During his cross-examination, Jones' attorney, Skylar Limpkeman, asked Furnish why he didn't investigate the audio issue back in 2016. Furnish said that at the time, he was too caught up with the Mitchell investigation. In response to a memo, Furnish wrote to Chief Wayne German, an internal investigation into Jones' inconsistency began in February. Lieutenant Ryan Abodili headed that investigation. Tuesday, he testified that he opted to interview Jones himself to determine whether he believed Jones had intentionally lied. But his conversation with Jones was unproductive. "I wanted to talk to him personally, to see what he had to say, and Lucas honestly probably could have easily cleared this up in my interview, and he chose not to do so, and continued to tell multiple stories and lie to me directly," he said. Abodili said Jones was evasive, answering direct questions with long-winded answers. Additionally, Abodili said Jones reverted to his original story, denying that he had intentionally turned off the audio. Limpkeman questioned Abodili's methods, asking the investigator whether he sought clarity from anyone else in the traffic stop. Abodili stated he had talked only to Jones and reviewed transcripts of the investigation, video of the traffic stop, and Jones' testimony. He did not contact or speak to the driver in the stop or the officer who was serving as Jones' backup that night, he said. In previous interviews with the Gazette, Jones said he had offered to take one or many polygraphs to prove he was not being deceptive. Ultimately, Jones hired Anthony Reistoffer to conduct the test, paying close to $1,000. Reistoffer also testified Tuesday, outlining his methods and concluding that Jones had been truthful when he answered questions. A polygraph examiner of 17 years, Reifstoffer says Jones showed no deception on his test. Jason Craig, one of the Des Moines attorneys representing the Cedar Rapids Police Department in the proceedings, called Reifstoffer's methods into question, asking why the examiner did not record video and audio of the testing. A hearing is scheduled to resume at 8 a.m. today and will be streamed on the city's Facebook page. Turning to today's editorial page, we have a guest column by Glenn Siders. Glenn is of Siders Development and president of the Greater Iowa City Area Home Builders Association. His article is entitled "Address Soaring Lumber Prices." As our economy battles back from the coronavirus-induced recession, housing has experienced the strongest rebound among individual economic sectors. From nearly the beginning of the pandemic, residential construction was deemed essential, ensuring residents a safe place to shelter. With mortgage applications high due to lower rates, demand for single-family homes remains a bright spot for the overall economy. In fact, through July of 2020, single-family permits were running 8% higher nationally compared to the same period in 2019. However, that recovery leg is threatened because of astronomical increases in lumber costs, insufficient domestic production and tariffs on Canadian sources have led to a staggering shortage that has skyrocketed prices. Since April, lumber prices have escalated more than 170%, resulting in a typical new single-family home increase of $16,000. Such sharp rises are unsustainable and will constrain housing supply, thereby exacerbating existing housing affordability woes. The public must be made aware of this crisis and its impact on our economic recovery and the American dream of home ownership. The White House needs to hear about it on behalf of the Greater Iowa City Area Home Builders Association and as a member of the Home Builders Association of Iowa and the National Association of Home Builders. I encourage community members to contact their congressional representatives and ask them to speak to the Trump administration about addressing soaring prices and the growing shortage by first urging domestic lumber producers to ramp up production, and next by making it a priority to work with Canada on a new softwood lumber agreement. The housing industry can do its part to continue creating jobs and leading the economy forward only if the administration addresses lumber prices and scarcity. Building 1,000 average single-family homes creates 2,900 full-time jobs and generates $110.96 million in taxes and fees for all levels of government to support police, firefighters, and schools. And I haven't even touched on multifamily homes and remodeling projects. The numbers continue to escalate. Action is needed now. And that guest column by Glenn Siders, who is president of the Greater Iowa City Area Home Builders Association. And we have two letters to the editor today. First, from Bruce D. Williams of Cedar Rapids. Bruce's letter is entitled, Make Garland a Compromise Pick for the Supreme Court. Regarding the current Supreme Court vacancy due to the recent death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a compromise that would avoid hypocrisy, both parties would support a vote before November 3, provided the nominee is Merrick Garland. That letter by Bruce D. Williams of Cedar Rapids. And the last letter is from Jerry Harrington of Iowa City. And that letter is entitled, Grassley's Binding Words on the Supreme Court. In 2016, I wrote Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley a letter protesting his refusal to hold hearings on President Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court. I received a reply from Senator Grassley. He cited Joe Biden in declaring that a nominee should not be confirmed during an election campaign, and because election season is well underway, no matter the qualifications of this nominee, the hyper-political environment would cause lasting harm to the court, to the nominee, and to the nation. A hearing under those circumstances would be all politics and no constitution. Furthermore, Grassley wrote, quote, the Senate's decision to exercise its constitutional power to withhold consent from a nominee until after the next president is sworn in will allow the nominee to receive fair consideration, as opposed to attempts from each party to promote its electoral agenda, end quote. These are the words of Chuck Grassley. He is bound to oppose any nominee to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg until after January 20, when the next president is sworn in. And any other position is the height of hypocrisy. That letter by Jerry Harrington of Iowa City. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Wednesday, September 23, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Billy Ray Alday, age 84, died Sunday, September 20, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy from lung cancer and COPD. A private family service will be held. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website, tribute page for Billy under photos and videos or media, starting at 2 p.m. Thursday, September 24. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Also from Cedar Rapids, Ronald H. Sevening, age 88, died Sunday, September 20 at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. Visitation is from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 24 at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service is at 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 25 at the funeral home. Burial is with military honors and will be held at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A reception will follow at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood. Also from Cedar Rapids, Mary F. Harker, age 89, died Sunday, September 20. The family will greet friends from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 24 at the Legacy Center, Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids, with a Trisagion service beginning at 7 p.m. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, September 25 at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. And also from Cedar Rapids, Megan Monson Martin, age 39, passed away unexpectedly. A celebration of life will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, September 26, at the Tehan Funeral Home at 3100 F Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids, with a short service to immediately follow. From Cedar Rapids, Barbara Ann Mers, age 72, died Sunday, September 20, at the Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. A funeral mass will be held at St. Pius X Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial will be at 3 p.m. Friday, September 25, at the Holy Trinity Cemeteries at Saints Peter and Paul Cemetery in rural Harper. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 24, at Saints Peter and Paul Church of Clear Creek in rural Harper. From Cedar Rapids, Vern Melvin Martinson, age 87, formerly of Springville, died Monday, September 21. The Tehan Funeral Home and Cremation Service is serving the family. From Cedar Rapids, Eleanor, also known as Ellie Mae Reeder, died on Tuesday, September 15, at the end stage of renal disease at her home, surrounded by her loving family. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, October 9, at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Rex R. Prunty, age 84, formerly of Swisher, Iowa, passed away Monday, September 21, at the Methwick community at the Woodlands. Family will greet friends from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 24, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A private family funeral service will take place Friday, September 25, at the funeral home. Burial with military honors will follow at Anderson Cemetery in Swisher. From Cedar Rapids, Terry Lynn Myers, age 62, died Monday, September 21, at the home of her son, Steve. Graveside services will start at 11 a.m. Friday at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. There will be a visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. From Cedar Rapids, Jeffrey, also known as Jeff David Seltrecht, age 60, died on Monday, September 21. Graveside services are at 2 p.m. Saturday at Spring Grove Cemetery in Covington. Tehan Funeral Home is serving the family. From Ann Arbor, Michigan, David G. McQuone, age 78, passed away Saturday at his home with his loving family by his side. The family has chosen an immediate cremation. A memorial service will be held at a later date in Colorado. From Center Point, Edward, also known as Ed Stephen Fisher, age 87, died Friday, September 18, at Heritage Specialty Care Center in Cedar Rapids. Private family burial will be held at Portable Cemetery in rural Manchester on September 30. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is assisting the family. And from Hiawatha, Jean Church, age 88, passed away peacefully on September 17. from Marion, Reese Harmon, age 66, of Marion, passed away on Monday, September 21, at his home in Marion, following a courageous 10-year battle with cancer. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, September 26, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. The family will greet friends 1 hour before the service. And from Iowa City, John Michael Hennis passed away suddenly of a heart ailment on Sunday, September 20. Per his request, his service will be held on a Friday so that his county boys can enjoy a 3-day weekend. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 24, at St. Mary's Hall in Oxford. Graveside services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, September 25, at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Oxford. Friends may meet at St. Mary's Hall in Oxford at 10:45 a.m. to join the procession to the cemetery. From Iowa City, Marvin, also known as Butch Mark Massans, age 72, died unexpectedly as a result of an accident at his home on Wednesday, September 16. There will be a time of public visitation held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Services. Private graveside services with military honors will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday at Memory Garden Cemetery. From Hiawatha, Gregdon M. Cole, age 64, passed away Monday, September 21. A private graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The family will host a public celebration of life from 2 to 4 p.m. Friday, September 25, at the Artisan Sanctuary in Marion. And from Marion, David W. Warren, age 53, died Wednesday, September 16. Per David's wishes, there will be no service. There will be a get-together at a later date to honor David. In other death notices today from Colesburg, Gilda LaVon Miller, age 92, died Friday, September 18. The Toik Allen Funeral Home in Guttenberg is assisting the family. From Decorah, Ethel Ellingson, age 92, died Sunday, September 20. The Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. From Harper's Ferry, Margaret Delaney, age 79, died Monday, September 21. The Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Lansing is assisting the family. From Independence, Pamela S. Carlson, age 72, died Friday, September 18. The White Funeral Home in Independence is helping with arrangements. From Maquoketa, Maxine F. Miller, age 85, died Monday, September 21. The Carson Celebration Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. And from North English, John, also known as Gene Eugene Dawson, age 89, died Monday, September 21. The Powell Funeral Home in North English is assisting the family. And from Walford, David Lawrence Uthoff, age 91, died Tuesday, September 22. The Brash Funeral Service in Norway is assisting the family. And from today's sports page, we have a girls' swimming story. It's entitled Metro Squads Find a Way Despite Homelessness. And this is an article by Mike Condon of the Gazette staff. The 2020 high school girls' swimming season in Iowa already was going to be a challenge with COVID-19 concerns. Then came the August 10 derecho that caused damage over much of Linn County. Among the damaged buildings were the swimming pools at three Cedar Rapids public high schools and, to a lesser extent, the Linn Mar Aquatics Center. With the season set to start at the end of August, adjustments had to be made. The pools at Washington and Jefferson weren't available at all in August, and the Kennedy Pool still isn't usable. Linn Mar's facility suffered minor damage and became the temporary home for all four schools during August. "We made quite a few adjustments when we were at Linn Mar going into the morning," said Washington coach Megan Lewis. "I've been beyond proud of our team. We are a small group, but we are making do and working hard together as well as trying to have some fun. The Warriors aren't alone in trying to have some fun in a year when you have to wonder what else could possibly go wrong. Jefferson and Kennedy experienced yet another oddity in a September 1 dual meet held at Linmar, a power outage right in the middle of a race, which eventually led to the suspension of the meet. The meet at Linmar was totally weird, said Jayhawks coach Jessica Hinkey. The power shutting off right in the middle of the 200-yard individual medley was crazy, but the girls made the most of it. Jefferson's pool is now available for practice and meets. Washington is only able to practice in its facility at this point with hopes of being able to host two late-season meets. Kennedy has become a road team in every sense of the word. The Cougars' practice schedule ranges from early mornings to late evenings. We are at Jefferson for our varsity group in the evening, said Kennedy coach Chad Durlin. We are at Washington for our junior varsity group in the evening, and diving is at Washington in the morning. Ironically, the Cougars, ranked 10th in the latest power rankings, have had the most competition so far. After dropping a close duel to Cedar Falls to open the season on August 25, Kennedy has a second-place finish at the Ram Relays in Dubuque, a team title at the Muscatine Invitational, and impressive dual wins over Dubuque-Wallert, Burlington, Dubuque-Hempstead, and Pleasant Valley. None of the other Metro teams have been in more than three varsity competitions before last night. The girls have done an amazing job of adjusting to the schedules, Durlin said. Dynamics at the meets have been pretty good. The teams that have hosted meets have done an amazing job of keeping it as safe as possible, following the guidelines that have been set by the state. Hinkey's team has athletes from Cedar Rapids Prairie and Jefferson, so she knows something about jumbled practice times and is happy to work with Kennedy on sharing a facility until repairs are complete at the Cougars pool. Chad told us right away not to worry about Kennedy, and they would swim whenever we are done, she said. That was a huge relief, since it's already hard enough figuring out practice between Jefferson and Prairie. Kennedy got their team poster this week, and I immediately hung it up on the pool deck at Jefferson. I remembered how hard it was to be away from our pool for 2 weeks. So if the Kennedy girls will feel a little more at home by seeing their roster on the wall, we might as well help them. We got our roster this weekend, so naturally it's up on the wall right next to Kennedy's. Lewis said it's just a relief the swimmers are getting a chance to compete. 2020 is a year like no other in many places. We are fortunate to have a season at all, and we are working to keep it going as long as possible. And here's a high school cross-country article entitled Officials Kicking Around Multiple State Meet Options. This is a story by Jeff Linder of the Gazette staff. A decision is expected by the end of the week on what the postseason will look like for high school cross-country. We're still in communication with the city of Fort Dodge and the Fort Dodge Community School District, considering options and deciding what it's going to look like, said Jared Cizek, Assistant Director for the Iowa High School Athletic Association. We'll have one more round of discussions. Then, by the end of the week, we should have something out to the public. The state qualifying meets, 5 in each class, are scheduled for October 22, and the state championships for October 31 at Lakeside Golf Course north of Fort Dodge. The traditional format remains a possibility, but is only one of several options. The state meet draws thousands of fans, the majority of whom run from point to point to watch the race from several angles. In an effort to decrease COVID-19 risk, there is discussion of making it a two-day Friday-Saturday event, with two classes, October 30, and two other classes on October 31. If that happens, it's possible for the state qualifiers for the October 30 races will be contested October 21. Other options, Cizek said, are making the state meet a two-week end event and or to restrict the number of fans in attendance. He also said that the number of qualifiers might be altered. Currently, three teams and 15 individuals from each state qualifying site advance to Fort Dodge. And here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Transgender Playmate, A Challenge for Grandma. Dear Abby, my 7-year-old granddaughter, Layla, has a playmate who is a transgender girl. My fear is that she may find out the truth and feel betrayed by her playmate, as well as me. Should I explain it to her? It doesn't matter to me that her friend is transgender, because I have always believed that a person's most important trait is having good morals. However, with respect to this subject, I feel that if I remain silent, it's as if I'm somehow betraying my granddaughter. Layla is very accepting of all people, and I don't believe it would change her relationship with the child as long as I explain everything to her about people who are trans. Any advice would be appreciated. And that's signed Progressive Gran in Arizona. And Abby responds, Dear Gran, do Layla's parents know about the friendship? Assuming they do, have a chat with them, as well as the playmate's parents, to make sure you're all on the same page. I do think it's time you start talking to your granddaughter about gender and what makes a girl and a boy a boy. At some point, her friend may feel comfortable enough about the friendship and herself to tell Layla herself. When that happens, be prepared to answer any questions your granddaughter may have. PFLAG is an excellent resource for LGBTQ issues and will be helpful to you if you reach out. Its website is pflag.org. And here's a story by Gage Meskimen of the Gazette staff. Iowa sees 19 new deaths from coronavirus and over 600 new cases. As the United States surpasses 200,000 deaths due to COVID-19, Iowa added 19 people to its statewide death count on Tuesday. Linn County had 2 of the deaths confirmed within the 24-hour period that ended at 11 a.m. Tuesday, according to data analyzed by the Gazette. Muscatine and Woodbury counties each had 2 new deaths. Polk County had 3. Alamakee, Boone, Clinton, Crawford, Dubuque, Fayette, Franklin, Howard, Pottawatomie, and Winnebago counties had 1 new death each. The state's total number of virus deaths sits at 1,285 as of Tuesday. Iowa added 640 virus cases within the 24-hour period, bringing Iowa's total to 81,209. Linn County added 23 new cases, bringing the county's total to 3,813. Linn's 7-day average is 39. Johnson County added 24 new cases, bringing its total to 5,025. The county's 7-day average is 24, its lowest since August 20. Story County added 27 cases for a total of 3,315. Its 7-day average is 23. Blackhawk County saw 26 new virus cases for a total of 4,382. The county's 7-day average is 27. Cases among younger Iowans continue to rise. Within the 24-hour period, 79 minors up to 17 years old were confirmed positive, bringing the statewide total to 6,509. 76 people who work in education have tested positive in the same period. Long-term care facilities continue to face virus outbreaks. Locally, Hiawatha Care Center now has 27 virus cases. 2 more recovered, making for a total of 9. Winslow Care Center in Marion added 2 more cases for a total of 41. 30 cases are labeled as recovered. 2 more facilities have been added to the statewide list. Rose Vista Home in Harrison County has 9 virus cases, and Call Home in Scott County has 5. Statewide, hospitalizations are up from 271 to 285. Intensive care patients are down from 74 to 72, and patients on ventilators are down from 35 to 34. And we have 3 Eastern Iowa briefs today. The first from Cedar Rapids is entitled Essential Items Donation Drive to Help Those Still Derecho Affected is Saturday. An essential items drive to support those still struggling post-derecho will be held Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Lindale Mall. The event, hosted by the mall, along with Horizons and HACAP, is coordinated by the United Way of East Central Iowa. The organizations encourage the community to bring donations of personal care items. Donations can be dropped off at the mall entrance on the First Avenue side of the mall between Von Maur and former Sears. Examples of essential items needed for the community include toothbrushes and toothpaste, denture care items, adult incontinence products, cleaning wipes, hand sanitizer, hand soap and laundry soap, dish soap, shampoo, conditioner, all-purpose cleaner, paper towels and toilet paper, deodorant, body wash, razors, bar soap, and tampons or pads. All essential items received will be given to HACAP and Horizons to distribute to their nonprofit networks who work with individuals in need. And from Linn County, Linn residents are encouraged to complete needs assessment questionnaire. Linn County residents impacted by the derecho are encouraged to complete the needs assessment questionnaire developed by community agencies including Linn County Public Health, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, HACAP, Waypoint, and other community partners. The information collected in this questionnaire will be used to identify needs that still exist following the derecho and may be shared with partner agencies in order to allocate resources. Help can include disaster case management. Anyone without internet access can call 319-892-6070 for help completing the questionnaire. And the questionnaire can be completed online at survey123.arcgis.com/share. This questionnaire is similar to the one provided by the cities of Cedar Rapids and Marion in the days following the derecho. A question has been added to assess the needs of rural residents, but the questionnaire is not limited to rural Linn County residents. Any Linn County resident can submit their responses. And from Iowa City, reserve a spot for Red Cedar Chamber Music's backyard concerts this weekend. Red Cedar Chamber Music is launching its 25th anniversary season with informal free backyard concerts at 3 p.m. Saturday and at 2 p.m. Sunday. The masked, physically distanced events will be staged at the home of core musicians Carrie Bastian and Miera Kim at 715 East College Street in Iowa City. Because space is limited, reservations are required. Email admin@redcedar.org with date and number of people attending. Chairs will be provided. Guests must wear masks and practice social distancing. For more information, go to redcedar.org. Also from the community page, 125 years and 125 masterworks. Cedar Rapids Museum of Arts puts prized pieces on display. This article by Diana Nolan of the Gazette staff. When you have more than 8,000 works at your fingertips, narrowing the selection to 125 becomes a monumental task, one that kept Kate Kunau busy for several months. As associate curator for the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, she usually builds exhibitions around a single artist or a theme, but for 125 masterworks from the collection, she had the depth and breadth of the museum's works from which to choose. From Saturday through January 17, visitors can see her selections, spanning the centuries from Roman antiquities to Andy Warhol's pop art styling. Any other human could have gone into the collection, picked out 125 pieces completely different from my 125, and it would have been equally as important, Kuhnau said. Definitely, every exhibition is a portrait of the curator and the person who designed it. I've chosen 125 really good, fun works that say a lot about our collecting process. Our first piece was collected in 1906, so we've been collecting for 114 years now. We've a very American collection, and we've changed with the times. We've always tried to include local artists in our collection, as well as artists that are on the national and international stages. It's really fun, she said, to go through the archives and find pieces she considers important, and the artists who should only be highlighted not only in the main floor, in the main first floor galleries, but also identifying the Grant Wood, Marvin Cohn, Mauricio Lisansky, and Roman works in their own galleries to include with special exhibitions placards. To underscore the diversity of the collection, she looked for works by artists from different decades, genders, and ethnicities. She began by going through the list of pieces given to or purchased by the museum, not the works in storage for the Cedar Rapids Community School District and the Cedar Rapids Public Library. List in hand, she started highlighting the artists who needed to be included in an exhibit celebrating the museum's 125th anniversary. Some pieces were pretty self-evident, she said, noting that she immediately could name 25 to 30 that needed to be included, like Grant Wood's Woman with Plants. Others are pieces that aren't displayed that often, or are lesser-known works by well-known artists. Then she had to decide which of the 5 to 250 holdings by a particular artist would best represent their works. The refining process took months, she said. It was very overwhelming at first, but I tackled just a little bit every day. The final winnowing took about 3 or 4 months, and she turned to Executive Director Sean Ulmer for advice, since he had been the museum's curator before stepping into his current role on an interim basis in 2013, then formerly in 2014. They were striving for variety, so museum visitors will see paintings, prints, watercolors, drawings, ceramics, glass, wood, bronze sculptures, and photographs. Among the big names are Spanish surrealist Salvador Dali, German Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer, French post-impressionist Paul Gauguin, Mary Grandpré, who's illustrated the Harry Potter book covers in the United States, Malvina Hoffman, Rodin's last pupil, American pop artists Jasper Johns, Andy Warhol, and Roy Lichtenstein, American illustrator and painter Norman Rockwell, Russian abstract artist Wassily Kandinsky, and French master Henri Matisse, and Spanish painter and Cubism pioneer Pablo Picasso. We have a very impressive collection, Kuhnau said. We do have a really impressive collection of works on paper. There are many prints and a lot of works by Picasso and Matisse and Giacometti are works on paper, so I think it's cool to highlight that's an area where we're very strong. The anniversary year is the chance for the museum to pull out all the stops for a celebration that began with a massive Impressionism touring show and will continue with 3 more wood retrospectives. 125 is a really big milestone, Kuhnau said. We're very excited that we've lasted that long, beginning as the Cedar Rapids Art Association in 1895. For me personally, it's become even more important because this year definitely has taken some turns that we haven't anticipated. it's kind of become a symbol of our resilience as an institution. Like we're having it. We're still going to get it in 2020. We're making it happen. We're going to keep on rolling with this, and it's going to be good. And here's the at-a-glance related to this article. What? It's 125 masterworks from the collection. At the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art at 410 3rd Avenue Southeast, and Saturday to January 17. The hours are noon to 4 p.m. Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Sunday from noon to 8, Thursday from 10 to 4, and Saturday, and it's closed on Monday. Admission is $8 for adults and $7 for college students and ages 62 and over, $4 for ages 6 to 18 and free, ages 5 and under. Face masks are required. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Wednesday, September 23. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.